Lecture 36, Globalization and World History.
The most exciting social science concept to hit the streets in the 1990s was the concept of globalization, focusing obviously on an intensification of contacts among various societies in the world to the extent that basic frameworks of life were set by these contacts. The theory was a social science theory initially, but a batch of historians calling themselves the New Global Historians have joined in, arguing that globalization is one of the most fundamental changes in human history that the species has yet experienced. Discussions of globalization are an inescapable part of dealing with the 20th and 21st centuries as a new period in world history, but there's really more involved. Today we'll be talking about globalization in historical context, but in broad historical context, because globalization provides an opportunity to look at the broad sweep of world history, not obviously in great detail, but in terms of key moments and key issues as a means of setting globalization in appropriate historical context. Globalization is most often discussed, of course, in terms of is it good, is it bad, how fast is it proceeding, what are the objections to it, and history will help with these issues for sure. But the primary first question for globalization is a focus on the extent of change involved, and where change is concerned, history is the inescapable disciplinary tool for assessment. We'll begin with a brief further definition of globalization itself, but then turn to the connection to world history reaching well back into materials we've covered previously in our discussions. Globalization, obviously, first and foremost, depends on a sense of rapid technological change, particularly in areas of communication and transportation. And as we've already noted, new connective technologies form a basic part of defining the 20th century as ushering in a new period in world history. Technologies such as the airplane, radio contacts, satellite television, the internet, born effectively in 1990. The list is long, and it parades at various points through the 20th and into the 21st centuries. Globalization also, however, involves a sense of range of activity. Globalization, for example, by the 21st century was touching the lives of children. In 2004, for example, the United Arab Emirates banned the use of boy jockeys in camel races, because as they approached globalization, they realized that world opinion would disapprove of this use of children in ways that would be disadvantageous to the Emirates generally. A year later, in 2005, the United States Supreme Court ruled that children could not be put to death for crimes, making the United States one of the last societies to agree on this issue. But when the Supreme Court did this, it specifically cited the importance of world opinion in setting standards to which the nation must adhere. Globalization can also be discussed, finally, not only in terms of technology and range, but in terms of optimism for the future. And frankly, here some silly things get said, such as, for example, the notion that two societies that have McDonald's will never go to war with each other. The notion being that once you get this far along in consumer interest, you'll turn away from war in the interest of further consumer pleasures. That would be nice to believe. I frankly am somewhat dubious. But the very fact that this kind of theory can be put forward calls attention to the extent to which globalization is seen as a new force. But before we conclude too briskly about globalization as a new force, we need to turn back to world history. And we begin, frankly, as we began the course itself, by noting that one of the key themes in world history throughout, from early to now, involves a recurrent tension between human interest in forming local and regional societies that have clearly established institutions and identities that provide a comforting, predictable framework for human existence, on the one hand, and on the other, the clear advantages or inescapability of contacts with other societies. These tensions began to emerge early. They've been progressively redefined, and in one key way, globalization is simply the latest iteration of a redefinition of these tensions. Early in the human experience, to go back briefly to the days of agriculture and early civilizations, early in the human experience, two aspects of what we still regard as globalization were already emerging. One, for example, was migration. People began migrating early, first to lands that had not been populated, but then subsequently, by the time of agriculture and civilization, to lands that had at least some other peoples in them. Migration is still a key feature of globalization. Of course, migration now can proceed over longer distances more quickly. It involves the possibility of going but also coming back in ways that can affect both the sending and receiving societies. So migration has changed with globalization, but it remains a force that we have to recognize launched early in the world historical experience. The spread of disease, another key aspect of globalization, also has early roots, as we have seen. Now, here too, there's change. Globalization allows disease to spread more rapidly. Globalization also begins to generate some institutions like the World Health Organization that we hope can have some role in stemming the impact of disease through global contacts. But the basic force is not new. In the early stages of the human experience, while contacts through migration, through the spread of disease, were crucial, for example, in spreading knowledge of agriculture, in these early stages of the human experience, contacts obviously formed a vital but subordinate theme in a situation where the key attention of leaders and ordinary people alike was being devoted to the formation of local and regional societies, clusters of institutions, clusters of cultural identities. When we dealt with the classical period, for example, we talked about a key system of contacts that connected the various classical societies from China in the east to Rome in the west, along routes such as the Great Silk Roads. But we also noted that while these contacts were interesting and clearly sparked consumer and merchant interest, they were not yet fundamental in shaping the identities of the societies that were forming in the classical period. At this point, the balance between regional on the one hand, contact on the other, was still slanted in favor of the regional. With the post-classical period, however, between about 500 CE and 1450 CE, we saw the balance decisively shift, and frankly, some world historians would argue that what we now call globalization really began around 1000 CE. This was the point at which, along with migration and disease spread, trade among various regions at this point in the old world, Afro-Eurasia, trade was now added to the list of factors that routinely and fundamentally connected various societies, creating new tastes, new dependencies on remote regions, allowing merchants to play a growing role not only in trade itself, but in certain kinds of cultural contacts. And from about 1000 CE onward, many world historians would argue, there's simply a recurrent intensification of the basic framework, rooted again initially in trade, the basic framework that would make contacts and convergences increasingly superior to regional identities in the balance that continued to shape the experience of peoples and societies in world history. The early modern period, with the addition of the Americas and then Oceania to the list of societies involved in global contacts, with the intensification of trade connections and biological connections, the early modern period clearly is another chapter, not necessarily a fundamental one, but clearly a very important one, in this ongoing process of the intensification of the importance of contacts in the human experience. So, as I've already implied, some world historians, particularly pointing to the post-classical period as a swing era, between primary focus on localities and regions and primary focus on contacts, some world historians would argue the framework's already set. And all we need to do with globalization is talk about subsequent tweaks, subsequent intensifications to patterns of interaction, dependencies on contact already well established. But there are two other alternatives to this view that don't wipe the view away, but argue for greater change in the last century or possibly two centuries. Candidate number one for slightly more focused attention is the long 19th century, and particularly its second half, where many historians now argue the process of globalization as distinct from earlier patterns of contact, the process of globalization really begins. Obviously, new technology is clearly involved even at this earlier phase, with steamshipping, the railroad, the telegraph, etc. Other developments, such as the Suez and Panama canals, helped link societies with more rapid connections than ever before, and obviously international trade was intensifying very rapidly, as we've seen as we talked about how societies progressively were drawn or compelled into the framework of international trade on terms that were sometimes not to their best liking. The long 19th century also saw the addition of two other features to the list of contacts that began to shape the human experience, along with migration, which obviously surges in the long 19th century, and disease impact, which has its moments as well, and obviously trade. Along with these three factors, now come first signs of what we would now call cultural globalization. At the end of the 19th century, most obviously, international sports interests were beginning to emerge for the first time. Based on European and American sports like soccer and baseball, people in various parts of the world, in Latin America, in Asia, in Africa, began in the late 19th and very early 20th centuries to pick up sports interests in ways that would continue to feed what we can clearly see as a key element of international culture from that point onward. Cultural globalization was then a factor we can identify about 200 years ago, or at least 150. The other new addition to the ranks was what we might call the early phases of political globalization. It was in the second half of the long 19th century that international agreements began to forge opportunities to send mail from one society to another, no matter where these societies were located in the world. Other agreements featured treatment of prisoners in war and so on, and also international non-governmental organizations bent on defending women's rights or attacking slavery began to shape international political discourse to some degree. So there's a good case to be made for the long 19th century, particularly with new technologies, but also with two crucial additions to the list of elements that were beginning to have international shape. There's a good case to be made for the long 19th century as the effective crucible of globalization as opposed to important kinds of contacts that had helped set the stage earlier in the world history experience. The 20th century raises two issues in this connection. The first is frankly unexpected, although of course we know it, and that is the extent to which the second quarter of the 20th century saw a number of societies actually deliberately pulling away from globalization, at least in part and sometimes virtually entirely, seeking to set their own economic patterns, their own cultural patterns, either new or traditional. The Soviet Union under Stalin pulled away. Japan and Germany pulled away to some extent, at least economically. The United States pulled away politically. China under Chairman Mao a little later would pull away for several crucial decades. In other words, a good argument for seeing the late 19th century as the effective beginning of globalization gets additional vigor when we realize that a whole host of developments in the first part of the 20th century can be seen as deliberate reactions to a globalization that was not yet acceptable, that was not yet seen as serving general interests adequately. But the second feature of the 20th century returns us to the question of the extent of change. By the second half of the 20th century, even amid the tensions of the Cold War, it becomes clear that the new connective technologies in communication and transportation, that new organizational capacity, particularly in the form of multinational corporations, that differed from earlier international business units in being able to locate production facilities, to specialize production facilities almost literally every place in the world to seek best labor and regulatory advantage. These multinationals, as they differed from previous international trading organizations, form a way to measure 20th century globalization as a partially new animal, along with technology itself. It's also in the 20th century that at least two final elements, final to date at least, get added to the globalization picture, along with intensified political and cultural globalization. First of all, as we increasingly realize, it's in the later 20th century that environmental change goes global. Instead of environmental impacts by human activities having mainly regional consequences, which had been true in the 19th century and even earlier with agriculture, now human activities in one region seem potentially or actually to have environmental impact on regions quite distant through the spread of acid rain, through nuclear disasters, and obviously through the forces of global warming. Along with environmental change comes the first set of explicit protests against globalization, beginning in 1999 in Seattle. Here was a sign, not that globalization was stirring discontent and concern, because that actually had occurred earlier, but globalization is now a sufficiently defined phenomenon that various groups with labor interests, environmental interests, concerns about excessive consumerism, various interests can now unite around an effort to see globalization itself as the key, if diffuse, target. So the 20th, 21st centuries can be seen as different even from the long 19th in the extent of technological change, in the accumulation of various aspects of global contact from early forces like migration and disease, through trade, through political and cultural globalization, now on to environmental and even protest mobilization. And it's this list that may convince people finally that it's the 20th and 21st centuries that actually see the crucial measures of globalization itself. The issue is, frankly, somewhat open. I think the two crucial points are, first, globalization almost inevitably must be viewed in the larger lens of world history. We have to turn back to previous types of contact and previous types of concern about contact in the name of local identity. We have to have this broader vision to see what's new, but also what's recapitulative about the globalization process itself. And we need this historical view, we need this perspective on the extent of current and prospective change. We need this also because this becomes a crucial part of assessing the quality of globalization. Is it good? Is it bad? Do economic advantages outweigh the costs to specific cultural identities? Do economic advantages themselves spread widely or uniformly enough? These are questions that I think take on new meaning and new capacity for assessment if we take the world historical view. World history contributes one other point of assessment that becomes crucial in discussions about what globalization is and where it's heading. And that is something that, again, we've done recurrently in our discussions of world history from 3500 BCE onward. And this element is the extent to which different societies, because of their prior historical experience and cultural and institutional contexts, respond differently to common forces of change. In other words, the extent to which different civilizations react to globalization in different ways because, again, of the kinds of experiences they've had in previous world history episodes, as well as differences in their contemporary approaches and experiences. Take, for example, the case of India. Many Indians find globalization, or at least partial accommodation to globalization, fairly easy because, after all, India has long been a society open to outside influences, reasonably tolerant. Obviously, the British experience in the colonial era is a particularly important instance of this, but even farther back in Indian history, we see an openness to outside contacts that helps explain why many Indians, particularly in the middle and upper classes, seem to be quite adept at accommodating to globalization without losing all sense of internal cultural identity. They'd done that before. On the other hand, again historically, India is also a stratified society in which other groups, particularly in the countryside, particularly in the lower classes, are much less impacted by globalization, much less drawn to it, so that one can see in Indian society differential accommodations to globalization, differential levels of tolerance, indeed, calling on earlier historical experiences. East Asia, Japan first and then China, form a second kind of case. Historically, without falling into the trap of seeing East Asia as somehow historically isolationist, which would really, as we've discussed before, be inaccurate, historically, it is nevertheless fair to say that East Asia has not usually been an active outreacher into the global environment. And here we have to note that beginning with Japan, and now more recently South Korea, and more recently still China, East Asia quite simply changed. Japan reached its crucial decisions about what we would now call globalization in the late 19th century, calling attention again to the 19th century as a crucial aspect of the globalization experience. And the Japanese decided that globalization could not be resisted, outside contacts and influences had to be addressed and accommodated, but obviously without fully losing a sense of Japanese distinctiveness and identity. The Japanese changed. In their wake, somewhat later, South Koreans would change, and more recently still, particularly beginning in 1978, the Chinese seem capable of a really impressive turnaround in light of their earlier history, in which they become active players and even eager participants in the globalization process. Here's a different package from that of India, based on a different set of historical experiences, but a package that seems quite successful in its own right because of the ability to change in light of global pressures and global opportunities. Sub-Saharan Africa is a third case. I think, frankly, that sub-Saharan African encounters with globalization in the 20th and 21st centuries must be best understood, so far at least, in terms of seeing globalization as a recent intensification of economic inequalities, international economic inequalities, that actually had begun to develop with the formation of the world economy in the early modern period. Africa obviously has various cultural connections with globalization, political connections as well in various rights agitations, etc., and the spread of democracy more recently. But so far, the crucial impact of globalization on Africa is to enhance the African position in the international economy as a supplier of relatively inexpensive raw materials and foods. Globalization is here, again, a contemporary instantiation of a system of trade inequalities that began several centuries earlier. Again, a third case. The point, I hope, is clear. Globalization is a force that requires response from every major part of the world. That's a new element. But it's a force that also gains responses based on the historical experience of different societies and the willingness and ability of different societies to alter that experience in light of globalization itself. It has to be seen as a common force, but one that generates a number of different stories based on different civilizational pasts. And it is, of course, crucial to remember that this process rouses resistance as well as accommodation. Different societies will see different aspects of globalization as menacing or at least troubling. The Middle East, for example, which accommodates significantly to globalization in many ways and divides over the eagerness with which this force is embraced, the Middle East obviously uses, many people in the Middle East at least, use a religious lens in which to view globalization and use Islam as the key shaper of this lens. Islam itself as an international force can accommodate to globalization, but it can also view aspects of globalization, particularly on the cultural side, as troubling and needing considerable constraint and regulation. Europeans embrace globalization in many ways more readily because they help set up the globalization system itself. They benefit from it in many obvious ways, but Europeans continue to worry about certain aspects of globalization, including, perhaps most obviously, the contemporary versions of the old pattern of human migration. Europeans and immigration set up a tension point at various junctures during the final decades of the 20th century and the early 21st, and these tensions have not fully been resolved. The United States, which has its own concerns about global migration, but probably handles this force a little bit more comfortably than Europeans do, the United States has its set of concerns about globalization, focused perhaps most obviously on issues of political sovereignty. The United States stands out from a number of societies in its reluctance to subscribe to political globalization, to international agreements that might seem to bind American freedom of action politically, even as most societies in Western Europe and many parts of Asia find these agreements more comfortable when they apply to landmines or environmental change or various issues of this sort. Each society then develops and emphasizes its own resistances based again on historical experience, based on a sense of what the crucial regional identity is that needs to be protected against globalization itself. World history, then, as we have seen it shaped over many millennia, provides a perspective on globalization, and globalization, in turn, provides an opportunity to renew our sense of why the world history enterprise is indeed a significant one. There are, as I hope many of us would agree, a whole batch of good reasons to be interested in history. The past is fascinating for its own sake. We see the varieties of possibilities in human response by looking at experiences in various societies through history. There are a batch of good stories. It can be seen as entertaining. All sorts of good reasons. But among them, and I would argue, frankly, primary among them, is the opportunity to see how the past shapes the present. And since our present is inescapably a global one, I trust it's at least arguable, if not absolutely clear, that world history becomes one of the crucial frameworks for historical knowledge that we need to explore in order to understand our own times. And very briefly, I admit, we've tried to use this last discussion as a way to see how that works, and let me recapitulate. If globalization is a new force, we can establish how new it is only by looking at previous historical experiences, and that means, in this instance, inescapably, world history. We need to understand that contacts are not a new phenomenon, that resistances are not new either, and then we need to say, well, but in the 19th century and maybe again in the later 20th century, while the basic tension between the regional and the global is not a brand new one. The terms of the tension changed crucially, and history helps us make that determination. World history is also essential, as we've just been discussing, in helping to determine why different societies react to globalization in different ways. They bring different cultural baggage. They bring different kinds of economic contacts with global forces, shaped not just recently, but in some cases going well back to the 16th and 17th centuries. We need history to see this aspect as well. And we need world history, finally, as the framework in which we can begin to sort out, looking at our own society, but also Africa or China or India, we can begin to sort out, well, as we begin to assess globalization and not simply define it. What's good about it? What's dubious? And what's probably bad? And what can we do, if anything, about any of those features? There's one final question to pose that comes straight from world history, that comes straight from the discussion we've been having here, that I think is an appropriate note to end on. We have argued, as will many world historians, that from 3500 BCE or so, using the concept of civilization is one, not the only, but one of the key mechanisms by which we can make sense of the variety of experiences that constitute world history. And we've argued that civilization is a form of human organization, but also that as individual civilizations developed, they formed identities and characteristics that would mark them off, in part, from other societies around them, that would allow their members to see themselves as somewhat different from societies the next continent over, or even the next subcontinent over. Civilization becomes, in this sense, a crucial form of identity as these factors develop through world history. But now the question. By the 21st century, under the impact of globalization, are we beginning to reach a point at which civilization itself, as an expression of identity, civilization itself will begin to yield ground to other more global forms of identity? Some world historians, not necessarily eager partisans of globalization, are arguing that that is in fact underway. That, for example, it's more important now for a scientist to talk to other scientists based on this identity, regardless of whether they come from Islam or Japan or the United States. Science becomes the crucial framework for discussions rather than civilization of origin. And the same might be held for certain kinds of athletes, for certain kinds of businessmen and managers, for certain kinds of social scientists as well as scientists. Are we beginning to see a situation in which, at least at the middle and upper class levels, civilization begins to take a back seat to other more global expressions of identity and training? I think this has to be a question. I don't think it can be answered yet. But if this is the case, it adds weight to the sense that we are in an era that is beginning to experience a fundamental shift away from some of the common currency that world history has maintained really for over 5,000 years. This is a possible. It's not yet definite. There are even those who argue that civilization will trump globalization and that we will see a new clash of civilizations focused particularly on tensions between Islam and the West. I not only hope that this view is incorrect, I believe it is unless it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. But it too calls attention to the extent to which we're at a point in world history at which we need to weigh what's persistent from the past, what's newly introduced thanks to new organizational forms, new human interests, new technologies. We don't know the future. We can raise questions that we can't answer. But what we do know is that we cannot even formulate sensible questions. We cannot even cast aside scenarios that, frankly, are dubious and risky without knowing the history that lies at their base. World history, in this sense, intriguing, I hope, in its own right, is a vital tool to help us sort out what shapes our present and what will shape our future.
We genuinely hope you have enjoyed these lectures from our Great Courses series. Our courses are available to order online. Visit our website at www.teach12.com or call our customer care representatives at 1-800-TEACH-12. That's 1-800-TEACH-12. Thank you very much.